Welcome to Tax Notes Talk, a podcast from Tax Notes, the leading source of tax news, information, and analysis.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm David Stewart, Editor-in-Chief of Tax Notes Today International. This week, TCJA at 5, State Edition. We're approaching the fifth anniversary of the passage of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which means that, yes, we've been talking about GILTI, FIDI, and the SALT cap for half a decade. To mark the occasion, we'll spend three episodes taking a closer look at how the TCJA has affected taxes on the state, federal, and international levels. This week's episode, the first in our series, takes a closer look at the TCJA's relationship with state taxes. Here to talk more about this is Tax Notes senior legal reporter, Andrea Muse. Andrea, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Dave. Glad to be back.
To start off, could you give us a brief overview of what effect the TCJA had on state taxes?
So since most states conform to the Internal Revenue Code, any federal tax change will impact states unless they decouple from the provision. For the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, there are several limitations on the provisions that impacted states. But what probably received the most attention is the $10,000 cap on state and local tax deduction, which only indirectly impacted states because it's a limitation on the federal deduction, but resulted in states enacting workarounds like the pass-through entity tax.
All right. I understand you recently talked to someone about this. Could you tell us about your guest?
Yes. I talked with Steve Wolodziszczak. He's a Tax Notes state columnist and retired principal with EY. He's written extensively about the state and local tax treatment of pass-through entities, including the enactment of pass-through entity taxes as workarounds for the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And he's a frequent speaker on state and local tax developments.
All right, let's go to that interview.
Hello, Steve, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Andrea. Good to chat with you again.
Yes, and we're talking about the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It's 5 years anniversary coming up, and you're an expert in how the states have reacted to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, so we wanted to talk with you about that. So I guess the first thing to start with would be, what did the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act do at the federal level, and why that mattered to states?
Well, the most significant thing the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act did was drop the federal corporate rate from 35%, which was among the highest in the world at the time, to 21%. I mean, to put that in context, that's a 40% rate reduction. And so that was a substantial component of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Another thing that it did that was very important from the state perspective was it provided pass-through business owners, you know, partners and S-corporation shareholders, with a special 20% rate for trader business income. And that was on top of all the other tax cuts that they provided. In exchange, what they did was they doubled the standard deduction from $12,000 to $24,000 for individuals married filing jointly, and provided for immediate expensing of R&D, and substantially changed the taxation of foreign income. I mean, for those of you who forget, there was a new base erosion anti-abuse tax that was generated in IRC 59A. Then they created this new thing called global intangible low tax income, or GILTI, Section 951A, essentially, and then something called foreign-derived intangible income. And on top of all that, they provided special treatment, a reduced federal tax rate for special foreign dividend income, a one-year-only deal under IRC 965. Now, what were the trade-offs? The trade-offs were, well, in exchange for the rate reduction, they also reduced deductions. So, for example, the most significant from the state and local perspective, I guess, would be the state and local tax deduction was limited to $10,000 annually for anybody filing jointly. And likewise, all these international provisions were intended to generate taxable income on income overseas and bring it into the U.S. tax system right away. Now, why were these TCJA changes important for state tax purposes? That comes down to the conformity issue, because most state income tax laws, they rely upon the IRC for determining their tax base. As changes happen to the IRC, you know, states have to decide from income tax purposes, is this something that they're going to conform to or not conform to? And depending on how the state income tax laws conform to the IRC, they came into play. But those were, Andrea, the major changes that happened under the TCJA.
And I guess for the conformity for states, as you said, it depends on the state, but you do have some states that automatically conform and then others that have to either pass legislation or actively conform to provisions?
One of the most significant components of state income taxation is the fact that they rely on the Internal Revenue Code as the base for determining state taxable income. I mean, that was a convenience that was created over 100 years ago when the states first started implementing their corporate income taxes. Everybody said, why make it hard on taxpayers? Let's just tie it to the Internal Revenue Code as it exists so you don't have to compute your base each time. But Andrew, as you point out, every single state does it differently. Some either automatically conform, known as rolling conformity states. A bunch of other states are what they call static conformity states, where they fix the Internal Revenue Code as a specific date. And yet there are even still others like Mississippi and Arkansas, which pick and choose sections that they're going to conform to and that they don't. And the most important part about this is those states that conform to the Internal Revenue Code and the TCJA issues generally saw revenue increases. And you go, well, why did that happen? And that happened because, remember, a substantial component of the trade-offs that were done under the TCJA included significant base changes. In other words, reducing deductions generally meant that if the states didn't do anything, if they did just nothing but conform, they would see increased tax revenues. And I remember when this first came out back in 2017, 2018, my colleague Andrew Phillips, a partner at Ernst & Young, and I undertook a little thought experiment. And that was simply, if the states did nothing and conformed to the TCJA, what would be the impact on state corporate income tax base be? Just the corporate income tax. And Andrew's a lot better than I am at the math and modeling. And he concluded that we came up with an overall 12% increase in state corporate income tax base. 12%. If you know you kept the state tax rates the same, one would expect a 12% increase in corporate tax revenues. And it's kind of ironic that, you know, looking back, we weren't too far off, even when you do take into consideration what was happening with respect to COVID and all that. One other interesting effect that happened that I don't think Andrew and I projected was corporations, I think, started to accelerate income early in the enactment of the TCJA, believing that, you know, this corporate rate reduction couldn't last forever. And so they accelerated income into these earlier years, which resulted in even higher taxable income and even more corporate tax revenues for the states. Because again, states, you didn't see the states reduce their corporate tax rates by 40% like the federal government did. So it was only natural that we'd see that tax base increase at the state level and tax revenues increasing at the state level.
Support for this podcast is provided by SafeSend. The lack of qualified candidates continues to cause issues in the profession, but progressive firms are empowering admin with tax automation software to do the heavy lifting. The SafeSend suite will save your admin staff hours on assembly, delivery, and e-signing of tax packages, saving money and making staff happier. And your staff deserve the sweet life this coming busy season. Schedule a demo to experience this workflow automation solution for yourself at safesend.com. That's safesend.com.
And I guess for, as you're saying, for states, it seems that as a net positive as far as revenues go, but were there some concerns? I know as you're talking, the TCJA limits the state and local tax deduction. And while that's not a direct impact to states, I'm sure that states had concerns about that, and how did they react?
I think it's kind of interesting that when you think about it, this limitation on the state and local tax deduction to $10,000 for single and married filing jointly, $5,000 for married filing separately, didn't directly affect state taxes, right? I mean, it wasn't a direct impact on the state taxes, but obviously what happened is individuals got pretty upset because they saw it as an increase, if you will, on their state tax liabilities. And this was particularly true with what one would call to be the high tax states. So there was a real political clamoring for some kind of changes to the SALT deduction so that the voters in those states who were most affected wouldn't be adversely affected by that. So the interesting thing is the SALT cap was something that, you know, was a target, I think, early on by some legislators to try and eliminate the SALT cap, but didn't happen. It's not as if Congress didn't try. I mean, if you go back after President Biden was elected, his signature plan was this Build Back Better Act. And as part of that deal, many of the Northeast congressmen threatened no SALT, no deal. I mean, basically what they were saying is they weren't going to support the president's legislative initiatives unless the SALT cap was repealed. So, for example, last summer, we saw the House pass an amendment increasing the cap to $80,000. We also saw the Senate pass its own amendment limiting the SALT cap only to taxpayers with income less than $500,000. And if you look at those numbers, even the CBO pointed out that that would only affect taxpayers in the top 1% of American taxpayers. The current limits probably amount to the top 99%. But in both cases, the CBO said 99% of personal income taxpayers would have benefited from the change. As we all know, Senator Manchin from West Virginia opposed the Build Back Better Act, and it fell apart last year, and those amendments ended up falling down by the wayside. And again, this summer, we saw the portions of the Build Back Better Act enacted as the Inflation Reduction Act. But interestingly, again, saying that the No Salt, No Act, well, that didn't happen, and they ended up reenacting or just not changing the Salt Deduction Act. Most of the changes that they made were the establishment of a new book income tax and federal tax surcharge and stock buybacks and budgeting items to the IRS, but nobody really touched the salt cap. And since it didn't make the last bill, I guess the answer here is this ever going to happen before it expires in, at the end of 2025? And, you know, with the last election and the fact that now we have a divided government, I don't think it seems very likely that we'll see any further changes in the TCJ salt cap.
And I know there were some states that went through the judiciary and filed litigation to ask the courts to find that the cap was unconstitutional, and that seemed to fail. I believe that the litigation has been concluded unsuccessfully.
Yeah, that was the very first thing that the states did. We saw New York joined by New Jersey, Connecticut, Maryland sue the federal government. The Trump administration challenged the constitutionality of the salt cap. The Southern District of New York District Court there, in a very thoughtful opinion, rejected that notion, saying that there wasn't any constitutional requirement that there be a deduction for state and local taxes. And this ended up going up to the Court of Appeals, which affirmed, and ultimately the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal from that court. So I think that the litigation angle is closed at this point. But then the state started doing a bunch of other things. We saw a bunch of states come up with what are called the salt deduction cap workarounds. And the first of that was creating what were called state-sponsored charities. Under these proposals, which we saw enacted in Maryland and Connecticut and New York, essentially what would happen is the state or local governments would sponsor a charity. And under that charity, the taxpayers could make contributions to the charity and then get a credit for their tax liabilities for the amount that was paid. These charities would, say, provide funding for public education and healthcare. And remember, there were no limitations imposed on charitable deductions, just on the salt cap. But the IRS quickly responded and in June 2019 adopted regulations that severely restricted the ability of to use this type of workaround and effectively close that strategy. Essentially, what they basically said was you can't do it unless the property that's contributed is 15% or less of the fair market value. And that really was no benefit. And so that really hasn't gotten very popular. Another proposal we saw was trying to shift the tax from individual employees to employers. Now, remember, individual employees, if they had withholding on their tax liability, that would be their personal tax liability subject to withholding, subject to the $10,000 salt cap. New York came up with an interesting enactment. They called it the New York Employers' Compensation Expense Tax. And how this would work, it would be elected by the employer. And it's, remember, the election is not by the employees, but by the employer. And then what would happen is then the employer would have a tax levied at a rate of 5% on the wages paid to the employees in excess of $40,000 each. Now, the eligible employees could then claim a credit against their personal income tax for the share of the ECET paid by the employer. Remember, arguably what you're doing is shifting the tax from the employee, who's subject to the salt deduction, to the employer, who would just treat it as an ordinary trade or business expense, which could still be deductible. Ironically, New York's the only state that enacted such a provision. And I took a look at some of the budget information from New York. And apparently, you know, if you take a look at the total amount of income tax that was collected in New York, this thing amounts to less than 0.1% of the $54 million collected in 2021. They only collected $3.2 million under that tax. So it really hasn't gotten very popular. And I haven't seen any other states enact that. But then that brings us to what was probably the biggest response, which is the salt PTE taxes. And what the PTE taxes are pass-through entity taxes. And the way this would work is essentially, instead of imposing the tax on distributive share of income that was received by the shareholders or the pass-through entity owners, the partners, who would pay it at the individual level, instead this would be a direct tax on the pass-through entity itself. And it's kind of interesting. Connecticut was the very first state to enact this in 2018, almost immediately after the TCJ was enacted. After Connecticut did this and after the IRS acquiesced, virtually every state has enacted one of these since then. And so it's kind of interesting to see how that's going to evolve. I guess we have 29 states that have this kind of a pass through entity tax.
And was it surprising how fast the states moved, particularly given the fact that the IRS hadn't issued any guidance until nearly 3 years later?
I wasn't very surprised at it, because if you think about the enactment of the pass-through entity taxes, it's no cost to the states. I mean, the states recognized, and the proponents of these taxes pointed out, that there would be no net loss, in fact, possibly a revenue increase to the states by enacting these pass-through entity taxes. And the only possibility here is the fact that maybe the IRS would deny the deduction, but there'd be no net loss to the state. So it didn't really surprise me that they were enacted so quickly. I think what really surprised me was the issuance of Notice 2020-75 and the IRS essentially acquiescing to this proposal. But as it is, you know, this is already enacted, and these provisions are going to be around until the TCJA provisions expire. Because remember, they expire in December 2025. And so I guess I really wasn't very surprised that there would be such rapid acceptance of the pass-through entity tax as something every state should have.
So with the rapid acceptance with the states, and as you said, the cap is supposed to expire in December of 2025, would you expect to see more guidance from the IRS on this issue?
I think the answer is no. I think what we have is all we're going to get. If you look at the IRS, they have so many responsibilities. And if you're a man, you know, but they have limited resources, right? Just like any other business. It's not as if the IRS has millions of people. I mean, I think there's only like 80,000 people in the entire IRS, and only a small portion are dedicated to rules and regulations. I mean, we've been waiting on rules, for example, on 385 provisions for almost, 20 years. And, you know, when you think about it, the IRS only has limited resources, and you have a provision that's going to expire after December 31st, 2025, and you already have members of Congress that have been threatening to repeal or change the provision. If you were the IRS, would you spend the resources to try and develop regulations beyond what you have already? I just don't think it's going to happen. But that creates a great deal of uncertainty with respect to, you know, how these provisions will work and how they would be applied. And I think that adds a little bit of uncertainty for taxpayers.
And I guess going to other provisions in the TCJA that impacted states, particularly the international provisions, what did you see with states reacting to those provisions?
When we first saw the international provisions, I think a lot of the states looked at this and said, well, we treat international provisions differently. And you go, well, why is that? Well, historically, the federal government subjected dividends from foreign subsidiaries to tax only when the income was received. The thought being, look, we're a worldwide tax system in the United States. We have offsetting income for activities overseas, but you essentially just tax the entities that are here in the United States and you leave the entities elsewhere alone. Then you had subpart F provisions and all that. But, you know, from the state perspective, you got to remember that the states were limited in a different way than that. The U.S. Supreme Court said that under the Foreign Commerce Clause, the states could not treat dividends received from foreign corporations differently than they do the dividends that are received from domestic companies. And that's under the Foreign Commerce Clause. And that was in a case called Kraft Foods versus Iowa Department of Revenue back in 1992. So in that sense, you know, the states had to take a look at these GILTI provisions and the international provisions and decide, gee, is this something that we can actually incorporate here, or are we going to run into constitutional concerns? Another interesting factor is, you know, the states like California already had worldwide combined reporting. When they looked at this, I think they quickly recognized we really don't need any of these provisions which accelerate income into the federal return, because we already subject that current income of unitary foreign subsidiaries in our state tax base. So theoretically, they didn't need any of the TCJA's international tax provisions. So when you put these all together, a lot of the states, I think rightly, recognize that none of them really applied to them. And so most states have decoupled from all those provisions, I think correctly, based upon, you know, the constitutional limitations, as well as the fact that their system is designed very differently than the federal government, and in essence already had a special regime for taxing international income.
Support for this podcast is provided by the Tax Attorney Recruiting Event. Are you looking to hire talented tax attorneys for your practice? Scheduled for Thursday, February 23rd, 2023, TARE, the largest tax attorney recruiting event in the country, brings together more than 150 graduate students from top-ranked tax LLM programs at the University of California Irvine School of Law, Boston University School of Law, the University of Florida Levin College of Law, and Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, allowing them to interview for positions with tax employers. Through TARE, employers will have the opportunity to pre-screen applications and select candidates with whom they wish to interview. Employers who wish to participate in TARE should visit the-tare.com. That's the-tare.com.
Any other provisions where states look closely at either decoupling or conforming?
You know, one provision in particular is Section 199A. Remember, this is the provision that provided a benefit to small businesses and pass-through entities by essentially giving them a 20% federal rate cut for trader business income and pass-through entities like partnerships, S corporations, and LLCs. The states, I think, properly recognized they didn't need to conform to this provision. Why? This provision was really created for federal purposes to provide some parity between C corporations and pass-through entities to say, you know, you gave a 40% rate cut to C corporations, businesses organized as C corporations, but what about us? And that's why the 198A provision came in. But from the state perspective, did the states reduce their tax rates as dramatically as the federal government? The answer is no. And so consequently, most states decoupled, and there wasn't really this disparity because there wasn't this disparity between the corporate and personal income tax rates. The one exception I think was really kind of interesting to me was the state of Iowa expressly coupled to 199A, even though they didn't have a corporate rate reduction. And I think that's really attributable to the legislative power of small businesses in that state. But overall, most states didn't conform to 199A. That's created, I think, some complications for taxpayers because it's a reduction in the tax base. It isn't a rate reduction, but a reduction in the tax base, a 20% reduction in the tax base that gets you to the same place. But a lot of states had to have a provision that provides for the add back or the elimination of the 199A reduction for federal purposes. So that's one element. The other one, which is much more problematic, is Section 163J, and that's the one that imposes a limitation on the amount of interest that business taxpayers can take against their taxable income. And that's been basically a nightmare for taxpayers to calculate at the state level. And the reason for this is 163J is a limitation on the amount of the interest deduction that was originally set up as 30% of adjusted taxable income and the company's business interest income. That would be the limitation each year. And that was adjusted to 50% by the CARES Act in response to the onset of the COVID pandemic back in 2020. But the key feature here is that this adjusted taxable income is essentially the same as EBITDA, earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, amortization, through 2021. But in the original TCAJA, they moved to eliminate the depreciation amortization computation in the ATI, making it much more restrictive. The one thing that's really interesting from a federal perspective, they're going to compute this limitation based on a consolidated basis of the company. And that adds a really interesting question from the state perspective. If a state's going to conform to this, how are you supposed to do it for state purposes? Most states don't have consolidated reporting. Most of them still are separate return reporting. And a lot of states have enacted something called combined reporting, which is different than the federal consolidated group reporting. And so consequently, if you're computing a 163J limitation and following those provisions for federal purposes, what are you supposed to do for state purposes when you might have separate reporting and there's no separate computation of 163J, or you're filing a combined report that doesn't have the same members of the combined reporting group, which happens frequently. And then on top of that, there's a provision to allow for you to carry over this 163 limitation amount into later years. And the problem there is, what happens when you're computing all this stuff? I mean, I challenge the fact that I don't think there's a supercomputer in the world that could follow 50 iterations. This is an incredibly complicated issue. And I think that's posed to, that's turned out to be a bit of a problem for a lot of businesses, both those in C corporation as well as pass-through entity form, because you know the state rules are so complicated and it's really difficult to figure out how those provisions are supposed to apply.
And so the answer there, I think you're saying, would be the states should just decouple from that provision?
I have been an advocate from the very beginning with 163J that the states should have decoupled it from the beginning. And the reason for that is one of the big problems that this was meant to address was the fact that you had deductions for interest that were paid to related businesses. Well, you know, that problem was eliminated through combined reporting for state purposes. And on top of that, you know, many states, even the separate return states, have enacted their own add-back rules. And so consequently, the states were, in my view, were always way ahead of the federal government on interest limitations and were doing it for the right reasons. And so there really was no need for this. But when you started putting all these complications on the 163J calculations and all these, you know, difficult decisions on how do you apply it to separate returns and combined returns, my thought was simply add back the limitations for state purposes and be done with it, rather than trying to create all these complications going forward with carryovers and the computation of the 163J limitation and what happens when you have differences in apportionment. I just thought it was going to be a big headache for the states and would just been better off just adding that back as an item for state purposes, which many states did.
Well, I guess as we said, it's a 5-year anniversary of the TCJA, and as you mentioned, there some of the provisions like the salt cap disappears in the end of 2025. I guess the question then is, what do you expect to see in the future, and maybe what issues should people look out for?
Well, the most important thing to keep in mind is many of the TCJA. Remember, the TCJA was enacted through a reconciliation process. In other words, the GOP did not have the votes in the Senate to go through the regular adoption process for these tax provisions. So consequently, under the paid-for requirements of reconciliation, the TCJA provisions are designed to self-destruct within a 10-year timeframe. So, for example, the salt cap is going to disappear for taxable years beginning after December 21st, 2025, unless Congress does something. And also, the corporate tax rate is going to jump from 21% back up to the progressive rate that flattens out at 35%, just as it existed before then. That's going to make some very difficult decisions come into play after the next presidential election in 2024. And the big question is going to be, who's going to be in control of Congress and who's going to be the president at that time? So it's kind of hard to project what's going to happen in that time frame. But the one thing that I do know that's not going to happen is, as I mentioned, I don't think there's going to be any changes in the TCJA during the next 2 years because of the divided Congress. So what could we see happen and what to look for? I think the states are going to have to decide what they're going to do with the TCJA provisions. You know, are they going to stay tied to it? I would think that would be the easy thing for taxpayers, but that's going to require an analysis on a state-by-state review. The other thing that I think is going to be interesting is state PTE taxes. I think a lot of the states are going to find out that they're making a lot of money off these state PTE taxes, and they're going to want to keep them as a permanent part of their tax plans. The real question for taxpayers is that what they, you know, local taxpayers, is that what they want? I guess, fortunately, a number of states, like California, for example, and Colorado, they expressly say that their pass-through entity tax expires if the TCJA is no longer going to be in effect. So we'll see how those all work out. But there's no doubt that the next 2 years, we're not going to see a lot of federal tax reform that would affect the state corporate and personal income taxes. But, you know, there's going to have to be planning for what's going to happen when the TCJA provisions expire. And that's going to be a difficult question to ask in 2024 and beyond.
Thanks for being on the podcast, Steve.
Well, Andrea, thanks for inviting me. This has been a real pleasure. And thanks for having the opportunity to chat with you.
And now, coming attractions. Each week, we highlight new and interesting commentary in our magazines. Joining me now is Acquisitions and Engagement Editor-in-Chief Paige Jones. Paige, what will you have for us?
Thanks, Dave. In Tax Notes Federal, Marie Sapiri reviews the greenhouse gases, regulated emissions, and energy use and technologies model for taxpayers who want to qualify for the new clean hydrogen credit. Mitchell Kane argues that the dispute over perpetual conservation easements just got worse. In Tax Notes State, Jeffrey Friedman and Siavash Ahmadi examine New York's False Claims Act tax meltdown. Robert Williams reviews a California tax case in which a new resident received a free basis step-up. In Tax Notes International, Michelle Markham examines the global standing of the OECD's new bilateral advanced pricing arrangement manual. Michael McDonald shares his observations on whether the arm's-length principle or formulary apportionment provides the best means of allocating income between associated enterprises. In Featured Analysis, Nana Amasarfo reviews upcoming priority actions for the OECD Global Forum on Transparency and Exchange of Information for Tax Purposes. And finally, on the Opinions page, Robert Goulder and Joe Thorndike break down the 2022 congressional midterm election results and their potential effects on tax policy.
That's it for this week. You can follow me online at TaxStew, that's STEW, and be sure to follow at TaxNotes for all things tax. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions for a future episode, you can email us at podcast@taxanalyst.org. And as always, if you like what we're doing here, please leave a rating or review wherever you download this podcast. We'll be back next week with another episode of Tax Notes Talk.
T-
Tax Notes Talk is a production of Tax Notes. You can learn more about us by visiting www.taxnotes.com/podcast. When major media wants the straight story, they turn to Tax Notes. Thank you for listening, and join us again for another edition of Tax Notes Talk. Tax Analysts, Inc. does not provide tax advice or tax preparation services. Nothing in the podcast constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice. A full disclaimer is included in the transcript.